House Bill 2828, and I'd like to have Steve Dole and Dan Swift up, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Dole of Crime Victims United of Oregon. We're here today to present to you House Bill 2828. This is a bill that that relates to drunken drivers who are repeat drunken drivers who cause the death or serious injury of another human being. In Oregon last year, there were over 200 people killed on our roads by drunken drivers. There were over 2,000 people injured by drunken drivers. In the United States of America, there were 17,000 people killed on our roads and over 500,000 injured. And there were approximately 25,000 DUIs issued in the state of Oregon last year. Unfortunately, some of the people who engage in this behavior don't learn they don't learn the first time. And the ones that are particularly troubling are those who have had a prior DUI homicide or a prior DUI assault, do their prison time, and then come out only to kill or seriously injure again. And what we're asking is that those people who have that on their record, when they are released from prison and go out and commit the crime a second time, that for a homicide, they are charged with murder, and for a assault, they are charged with assault in the first degree. Also, the bill provides that if you have three or more DUIs on your record, and remember in Oregon, the first time you get a DUI, you get diversion. So really, we're talking about four or more. That you also, if you kill or injure, you are charged with murder or assault in the first degree. This has to do with a felony offense. This has to do with commission of a crime while committing a felony. And for those who have killed or injured before, it has to do with the fact that they know, because they've been in that position before, they know what the ramifications are of driving drunk are. So with that, we have some cases that we want you to hear today. I'm going to turn it over to Dan for his testimony, and after that I'll ask you to call Jane Furlich and her sister and mother, and I'd like to, if I could, with your permission, Chair, stay up there with them.
Yes, you could.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Swift. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I have been a professional police officer for over 19 years now. I have spent the vast majority of that time doing traffic enforcement and chasing drunk drivers. To date in my career, I've apprehended over 1,600 impaired drivers between my 12 years as a deputy sheriff in Southern California and my 7 years as an Oregon State Trooper. In California, some of the problems, well, I don't need to explain to obviously a panel that has so many officers on it, the carnage and injuries that impaired drivers cause on our highways. Instead, what I'm going to talk about is the repeat offender who is the most dangerous. They're the ones that we have to get off the road because they're the ones that are drinking, they've been caught before, they know they're dangerous, and they choose to ignore that risk. And they put the rest of us at risk every time they get on the road because they just don't care. About 15 years ago in California, there were some similar problems where a person would drive under the influence, they had prior convictions, they would hit another car, they would kill or injure people, and the worst they could get would be about 3 years in the state penitentiary. The California legislature passed a law making, under certain conditions, a driving under the influence collision with a fatality, murder in the second degree. One of the things that they had to prove in that was, one, the person had to have a prior conviction for DUI, which indicated the person had knowledge that driving under the influence was dangerous, and two, they had to be operating a motor vehicle under the influence with gross negligence. California differentiates negligence from gross negligence, so you had to have some extenuating circumstance, but if you're under the influence, driving wanton disregard for public safety, and you have a prior DUI, all three of those combined would allow the state to charge you with murder in the second degree. As a deputy sheriff in Riverside County, I had the privilege of working a case that became the first murder and the second degree conviction for a DUI in the history of the state of California. In addition to that, they also differentiate manslaughter with gross negligence while under the influence. And that one, you didn't even have to have a prior. You just had to be operating a motor vehicle under the influence and manifesting extreme indifference to human life, and that could get you the manslaughter conviction, which was a minimum of 10 years in the state penitentiary. The reason I am bringing these up is because there are laws out there. My personal opinion is if a person has been driving under the influence and been caught three separate times, given the NHTSA standards of which we catch people and the times they drive under the influence and aren't apprehended, we're playing Russian roulette with the lives of our citizens out there. These people know that they are dangerous. They've been caught. They've been told. They choose to ignore that. They choose to put the rest of us at risk, and all we're trying to do is move down Oregon's public highways. Members of this committee, I strongly urge the support of this bill. I would actually, given my preference, would like to see that number from 3 reduced down, but I also understand the realities in which we all operate in this world today. Therefore, the Oregon State Police Officers Association strongly endorses this bill and would like to see it moved out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Chair, I failed to mention one thing on the bill that I want to make clear, is that when we discuss the issue of murder, we're talking about non-aggravated murder here. We're talking about murder. So this would not include capital offense. This under Measure 11 would be a 25-year minimum. Thank you.
Thank you for clarifying that. Okay, thank you, Dan. Any questions to the panel? Thank you.
I'm so glad I seen them hanging out my table. I'm so happy. The table that I made for everyone?
Yeah.
Or do you have a table?
Yes, I do.
Well, probably in a different file, I guess.
All right, please.
Good morning, Chair Barker. My name is Jane Furlich. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm from Washington County, and with me today is my sister-in-law, Maureen Furlich, and mother-in-law, Angela Furlich, also from Washington County. Have you ever set out for the beach on a nice sunny day? Did you take your family? Maybe you went on Highway 26 out toward Cannon Beach, and maybe you stopped at the Sitka Spruce. Did you marvel at how big it was? Maybe you even ran around it. What if that was your last memory on Earth? Would it be enough? Would it be enough for your family? Angela Furlich has that last memory of Jennifer and Martin Furlich, and it isn't enough. Jennifer and Martin were killed just a few minutes after easing back onto Highway 26 after visiting the Sitka Spruce. They were planning to spend the day at Cannon Beach, but someone killed them. And this man has killed before. Early in the morning on July 18th, 1999, James Lincoln Willie stole his friend's methadone, mixed it with Valium and Klonopin, and other prescription drugs that his probation officer said he liked to mix with alcohol, ingested it, and drove his Ford Econoline over the center line. Not once, but several times that clear, sunny Sunday. First, he did a hit and run in Astoria. Then he almost hit a school bus full of high school athletes. Then he came over the center line toward the Honda Accord driven by Martin. Martin tried to pull over to the right, but there was a ditch. He slammed on the brakes, but the van hit him head-on, killing him instantly. Angela heard a roaring noise, looked at Martin, saw the steering wheel impaled into his chest, and knew he was gone. Her husband of 43 years was gone. Quickly, she looked to the back seat where Jennifer had been sitting. 12-year-old Jennifer was already laying down and already turning blue. Then Angela heard herself screaming. It's been 5 years and 8 months since we entered this nightmare. How many times have we awoken screaming? How many times have we broken down crying? How many times have we asked, why us? How many times have we asked, why was he even on the road? James Willie had killed his wife and best friend while driving drunk in 1977. He was convicted of criminally negligent homicide and received a sentence of 5 years. He only served 2 years and 4 months. After his release, he was convicted several times for DUIs, multiple assaults, robberies, and a hit and run in 1987 that caused injury while he was driving with a suspended license. He received a fine of $750 and 5 years of probation for that one. James Willie had his license revoked 6 times in Oregon, yet he was driving on the road that day. James Willie was convicted of 2 counts of manslaughter, 2 for killing Martin and Jennifer, and 1 count of assault, 2 for seriously injuring Angela. We agreed to a plea bargain of 16 years. 16 years for 2 deaths and 1 serious injury. That's all. However, at the time, we thought it would be a life sentence for Willie because his health was so poor due to his drug abuse. Who knew that Willie could actually get healthier in prison? He will get out in about 10 more years. And even though he knows what happens when he drives while intoxicated, he'll probably still do it. And innocent people will die. I was asked to tell you about how our lives have been changed by James Willie's murder spree. Our family lost our father, our Opa, a generous and loving man who could fix anything. A wise man, the youngest of 6 and the only boy in his family, the one who took care of everything, the one we all turned to for advice and help, whether it was money matters or how to do something. His wife, Angela, has to hire someone to do the work Martin used to do. She asked her son to take care of her finances now. She thinks she may have to sell the house that Martin built. She worries constantly. Angela barely survived the crash, and she is here today to show you how this horrible crime has affected her. Her multiple injuries have broken bones, her humerus was broken, her foot, ribs, and had a shattered eye orbit. She had several head injuries, a concussion, facial fractures, and lacerations. Collapsed lung, lacerated liver, deep bruising, and multiple lacerations on her body, and they still plague her today. She continues to receive physical therapy because her back and shoulders and arm never healed properly after the crash. Her right arm healed crookedly, and rather than have another surgery to re-break it, which she couldn't face after so many days in the hospital, she just let it go. She tends to overdo things because it's only her now to take care of the house and the large yard. She's often anxious, tired, and depressed. Maureen is here, and she continues to grieve for the loss of her only child, Jennifer, every day. Every day she wakes up hoping it was a bad dream. But the dream is real, and so is the pain. The pain is so bad that even though Maureen is sitting here today, she is not able to speak about her loss. Everything Maureen did in life, she did with Jennifer in mind. As a single parent, she moved back in with her parents so they could help raise Jennifer. Maureen worked 2 jobs so Jennifer could have nice clothes. She planned her work schedule to be home when Jennifer was home. Now there was no one to care for, no one she has to be home for. There will be no dates for Jennifer, no prom, no college, no wedding, no career as an artist or a poet or an interior designer. Jennifer was dyslexic and she struggled in school, but she was the kind of student every teacher loved to have. She overcame her dyslexia to become a profound poet. She was very helpful at school and she was a buddy to the younger kids at Mary Woodward Elementary in Tigard, Oregon. When one little boy broke his leg and couldn't participate in a big dance performance, Jennifer wiped away his tears and told him she would be his legs. She pushed his wheelchair for the big dance number as he sang and gestured with his hands. Because of her own struggles, she was always sensitive to others' needs. But did Willie care? No. Because James Willie crashed into her, causing her brain to hemorrhage, killing her the next day. This year is especially hard because Jennifer would have been a senior in high school, but we won't be watching her graduate. We'll just go visit her grave. My daughter Maria was especially close to Jennifer. We have not been able to take Maria to the beach since this happened. She's afraid she'll be killed before she gets there. And with all the repeat DUI drivers on the road, 1/3 of all DUI arrests are repeat offenders, and 40% of all traffic deaths are alcohol-related. This certainly can happen. I support House Bill 2828 because repeat DUI drivers who kill and seriously injure innocent people should get the mandatory sentence of 25 years. They know the consequences of their actions because it happened before. Keep these repeat offenders in prison longer so no other family will have to go through our nightmare. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? I want to thank you very much for coming and doing that. I can't imagine how hard that is for all of you to be here today. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
The next people are Sylvia Howell, Ann Pratt, Bruce Pratt, and Kirsten Snowden. Please, if you want to come forward, if you pull up the chair.
Good morning. Chair Barker and committee. My name is Sylvia Howell. My mother was a victim of a DUI. And I'm here to support House Bill 2971 and 2828. On November 10th, 2000, a Friday night, Richard Chavez drove over 5 miles with speeds up to 85 and 90 miles an hour in the fast lane of the opposing traffic on Highway 138 east of Roseburg. He hit my mother's car head on, killing her instantly. She was 71 years old. Thomas Selman, my mother's companion, was driving and Mom was in the front passenger seat. It took 30 minutes for him to peel the top of the roof off just to get Tom and Mom's body out. He was taken to Mercy Medical Hospital, and later that night he was air flighted to Oregon Health Science University Hospital by airplane. He received massive pelvic injuries, broken right and left femurs, broken right and left ankles, crushed right foot, and he had massive internal chest injuries. His heart stopped on the flight up, and they resuscitated him. It again stopped in the ER after he had arrived, and again within the first 3 days of an intensive care, they resuscitated him again. He spent 1 month in intensive care and then another month and a half on their intensive care unit before he was released to a nursing home in Roseburg, where he again spent another month and a half before being discharged to his family's care. Mom's car insurance only took care of the first 24 hours of Tom's care. Oregon taxpayers paid for the rest of his care, which was well over $200,000. As to this date, he is still incurring medical bills, and he will for the rest of his life. My mother received multiple blunt force injuries to all of her body and died instantly. Funeral Cross, we held two funerals, one here in Roseburg and one in Oklahoma, because that's where we were all from and our family. It cost well over $15,000 just to bury her. Probate, hiring a lawyer to help out. Lawyer received over $25,000. Mom's insurance was not enough to even begin to care. My family and I lost probably over $50,000 just trying to be there every time he appeared in court, which over three years was quite a bit. But we finally got the conviction. Fatal accidents caused by drunk drivers alter the families of loved ones that they've lost. Mom lived with us on our property in Glide. Her house still stands empty because I can't stand the thought of anybody going in. Her front door, I open mine and her front door is 50 feet from us. I have daily remembrance of her loss. We must pass by where she was killed to go to town for any of our needs, doctor's appointments, even to see my daughters. We've got to go past where she was killed. She was a mother. She had grandchildren. She had great-grandchildren. She was the heart of our family. Mom could give you a hug, and she didn't hug just with your arms. She hugged with her whole body. Grandchildren. Mom was so young, 71, she didn't like being around older people. She did not want to be called a senior citizen. Her greatest love was her children and her grandbabies. She and Tom were on their way to pick up my grandchildren to spend the night when they were killed. I was diagnosed with a fatal disease in 94. My mom was my supporter. She took care of me. When I was sick, I was nothing to wake up and be flowers. I don't have her anymore. We don't have her anymore. All because of a drunk driver. I believe we need to pass stronger bills to give a message that if a person continues to drink and drive without the care of themselves or innocent human beings, they've got to pay dearly for it, especially repeat offenders. Stricter laws will make them think, hopefully, before they get behind a wheel of a car. Mom's life was a preventable waste. Some facts about Mr. Chavez. His blood alcohol was 0.227 at the time of the accident. He had four outstanding warrants from Yakima County, Washington at the time. He had no driver's license. He had a Washington ID. He did not have an organ. He was revoked in Oregon. He had 11 previous DUIs. One of them for a bicycle in which he hit a person. Two of those were also in the Roseburg area. He never finished any court-appointed programs for alcohol abuse. He's been a habitual offender since he was a teenager. Of course, he had no car insurance, so the state of Oregon paid for his stay in the intensive care until he could be released to Washington and then brought back. Oregon taxpayers also paid for his court-appointed attorney in the trial. There was 11 witnesses that the police took names of that testified to his driving, the smell of alcohol, and him hitting my mother head on. I was also there that night. It didn't take me long to realize I worked across from the fire station. And as they kept going out, it took every bit of our equipment. And people would come in and tell me a little bit. I knew it was my fault. So I went to her. And he wouldn't let me near her. Richard Chavez was convicted by a jury on 3 counts. Manslaughter, first degree, sentenced to 130 months. Assault, 2, sentenced 70 months. DUI, 12 months. And they were all to be served consecutive of each count. I want to thank you for the opportunity. This is my Mother's Day present to my mother. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name's Ann Pratt, for the record. I actually don't have my own testimony, but I've been requested by Connie Buchanan to read her statement, and she felt, and we feel it's important to get it into the record. She was called away out of state because of family illness. I've also turned in testimony. Mothers Against Drunk Driving supports this guilty of position statement. Connie supports this bill. She lives in Central Point. She's a retired nurse practitioner, and her specialty was mental health, and she's also done drug and alcohol counseling. And she states she never thought this would happen to her. She says it's no secret that drinking under the influence is a crime. However, there is a segment of our population that believe they are above the law, or they can handle their liquor better than other people, or they just don't get caught. We're all capable of learning. Our judicial system is built on that premises. Otherwise, we would just send everyone who doesn't follow the rules to prison and leave them there for the rest of their lives. Obviously, that doesn't make sense. So we give people a second chance and encourage them to do better with their lives. Having a child die is the worst thing that can happen to a parent. Having them killed by an impaired driver compounds that loss. DUI is 100% preventable. People who are killed by drunk drivers are just as dead as if they were shot by a gun. In our case, a drunk driver killed our youngest son, Dave, who was 21 at the time. Dave had been drinking with his friends and rode in a vehicle with his friend, John, who had also been drinking. The friend lost control of the vehicle and crashed. Dave was killed. John was charged with DUI, second-degree manslaughter, and criminally negligent homicide. He was sentenced to a $1,000 fine, 100 hours of community service, alcohol education, and to attend a victim impact panel. John completed all of those requirements. I spoke at his sentencing and told the judge we wanted John to get some alcohol education about the short and long-term effects of alcohol, how alcohol affects his reflexes, judgment, relationships, as well as the health problems caused from prolonged use of alcohol. We had just lost our son and felt John could learn from this and get on with his life. We thought that having to live with the fact that he had killed Dave would help him make different choices. John did not learn from all this process. He continued to drink and drive. And almost 10 years to the day from the date Dave was killed, John killed yet another friend who was a passenger in his pickup truck. His blood alcohol content was 0.10 the first time when he killed Dave. It was 0.296 the second time. Obviously, he had progressed down the road of poor choices. He has now killed two people. Even that did not stop him from drinking and driving. While he was out on bail for the second DUI and manslaughter charges, he continued to drink and drive. He was picked up and his bail revoked, and he remained in jail until his trial. Behavioral scientists say the best predecessor of predictor of future behavior is past behavior. If we learn from our mistakes and poor choices, that is great. Then we start down a different path in our lives and make better choices. People who have been convicted of several DUIs or have seriously injured or killed someone under the influence and continue to drink or use and drive are unwilling to make the decisions necessary not to indulge and then get behind the wheel of a car, of a vehicle. When a person chooses to use and drive, they are a homicide in progress. Who will their next victim be? It might be a whole family that gets head-on and killed. House Bill 2971/2828 is not talking about the first offense. It deals with people who have shown that they will not play by the rules. They must have three DUI convictions in the past or have killed or seriously injured someone in order for this bill to apply. What we have been doing is not working. We need to get these people off the streets. I encourage you to pass House Bill 2828. The legislature has an obligation to help protect the public and keep our communities safe. Act now. Take a stand. The life you save may be your own or that of someone you love or someone who is important in your life. I never in my wildest dreams thought it would happen to me, but in a blink of an eye, it could happen to you. Please pass House Bill 2828. John, for the record, John Patrick Bush was sentenced to manslaughter 2 and will be out in approximately 6 years. He's only 29 years old, and when he gets out, he will be 35. He has many more years. And hopefully he will change his behavior, but it doesn't look real promising. This bill is supported by Crime Victims United, MAD, Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and Oregon District Attorneys Association. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Pratt, Crime Victims United. House Bill 2828 is an extremely important bill in that it addresses the repeat and flagrant DUI offender. These culprits deeply impact Oregonians by their selfish acts that kill and maim. I would like to relate one victim's story. This is Buffalo Zobel's excruciating experience in 2000. It says, Chair Barker and members of the committee, I wish I could be there to testify today and support the proposed legislation, but business commitments take me away. My first thoughts were of anger at Timothy Soldani, the person who hit me while driving drunk. Then these feelings turned to anger at the system. I believe the system needs to do much more to address these dangerous, hardcore, repeat offenders who continue to drive while intoxicated by holding them more appropriately accountable. I believe House Bill 2828 does just that. This is what happened to me. Around 7:15 on the morning of Saturday, June 24th in the year 2000, I left my house on a 17-mile marathon training run.
I was running along Borland Road in West Lynn, which is a moderately traveled country road with clearly marked shoulders. I was running west on the shoulder, facing eastbound and the oncoming traffic. Timothy Soldani was also traveling west on Borland Road. He crossed over the double yellow center line across eastbound traffic lane and onto the shoulder and struck me from behind with his car. From the impact, I was thrown into the car's windshield, crashing to the driver's side, then careening off the back of the car. It was bad enough that Mr. Soldani was intoxicated and driving with a suspended license in a stolen car. But he fled the scene of the accident. I was very fortunate that there were people nearby who came to my aid and called police and the ambulance. These people indeed saved my life. It was a miracle that I am alive. This was not the first time Mr. Soldani had been cited or convicted of DUII. In 1996, he was convicted of DUII. In early 2000, he was cited for driving with a blood alcohol content of 0.12. He was cited again in March of 2000 when he refused the breathalyzer test. In my case, he was apprehended in Lake Oswego shortly after he hit me, but he refused the breathalyzer test at the scene. It was 3 hours later at 7:30 a.m., before he was forced to give blood sample for alcohol level, and it was a 0.13. It was estimated to be a 0.17 at the time of collision. Timothy Soldani was found guilty and sentenced to 8 years for assault two, felony hit run, unauthorized use of a vehicle, DUII, and driving with a suspended license. I believe this is not long enough to make a difference for this type of violent offender, and the punishment does not fit the crime. House Bill 2828 will help strengthen the convictions and penalties for drunk driving and may also deter more people from driving under the influence. I believe these DUII repeat offenders should face more severe consequences for the reckless choices that can kill and maim innocent victims. This has severely affected my life and the lives of my wife, my family, and friends. The pain and suffering we've all been through has been tremendous. I was in the hospital for almost 6 weeks. The doctors performed 14 surgeries in the first 2.5 years to totally reconstruct the lower part of both my legs. My 15th surgery was to rebuild my shoulder. In less than a year, my medical bills far exceeded $250,000. I was once very active, a marathon runner, and now I struggle to even walk normally. Because of Mr. Soldani's action, I am in pain every day and probably will be for the rest of my life. But I consider myself lucky to be alive. Many families have lost loved ones to drunk drivers. If this bill becomes law and prevents just one person from going through the agony that I have, then you will have succeeded. Now, Buffalo Zobel is again a productive member of society. In spite of being struck down by Timothy Soldani almost 5 years ago, did Mr. Soldani learn anything from the first time he was convicted of DUI and his subsequent treatment, or his second or third? The devastation to the victim's family is beyond comprehension. The pain of watching a loved one suffer through many operations and endless physical therapy is excruciating. This bill, if it becomes law, will be one more step in the prevention of this crime. These are senseless and preventable deaths and injuries. Now's the time to prevent them. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Ms. Snowden. Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Snowden, and I'm a Multnomah County Deputy District Attorney. I've been working in Multnomah County as a DA for the past 7 years, and I appreciate the opportunity to come down here this morning and give you the prosecutor's perspective on House Bill 2828. As I know you're all aware, DUII affects various members of the community, not just the victims themselves. We've heard just some tragic stories this morning, but the people that drink and drive themselves come from all cross sections of our community. And quite simply, that's really what diversion is for. There are folks that drink and drive and learn from their mistakes. This happens every day. I've seen it as a prosecutor. When I began in the office, I began prosecuting misdemeanor DUII cases. Then, after the passage of the felony DUII law, I prosecuted all of those felony DUIIs for Multnomah County for about a year and a half. And for about the past 4 years, I've been working in our traffic division, major traffic felony division, and prosecuting serious assaults and vehicular homicides as a result of drunken drivers. And during my time as a prosecutor, seeing the types of folks that commit these crimes, there is a big difference between the type of person who does this once, who is remorseful, who goes out of their way to make sure it never happens again, who engages in treatment, who goes and attends the victims panel, as is required of everyone participating in DUII diversion. It's also required of everyone as a condition of probation for a conviction for DUII. These folks change their lives as a result for the better. There is a different kind of person, however, that unfortunately I see more than I'd like to. And this type of person, quite frankly, doesn't care. This is the type of person that I see who ends up with 13, 16, even over 20 different convictions for DUII. And I've seen those people. And oftentimes, it's just by sheer luck that they don't end up killing people over and over and over again. But there are those folks, like we've heard the stories today, that do that. And the reality is, for those folks, it doesn't matter. They won't learn from their mistakes. And when they're drinking and driving, and it's for the 10th time, and they're caught, and they've already hurt someone, and they've already killed someone, they've already attended the classes, by their actions, they have said to our community, "My interest in driving is more important to me than the community's interest in safety." These are the folks that take on a truly criminal mindset, because while it might be a sad reality that addiction to drugs or to alcohol is something that folks have to struggle with, the decision to drive is not an addiction. There's no excuse for that. The folks that continue to get behind the wheel after they are impaired are as dangerous to our society as someone running down the street randomly firing off a weapon. This bill would send a very strong message to those folks. This bill would tell them, their defense attorneys would tell them, when they're in court facing yet another DUII conviction, if you are convicted of any form of assault or vehicular homicide, if this occurs and someone's injured, you will be facing assault in the first degree. You will be facing murder charges. Just maybe that will be enough to change these folks' behavior. Maybe their own self-interest is what they need to keep them off the streets, to have them decide to take a cab, to get a ride from someone else. If they're unable to beat their addiction, maybe that's simply what it might take to keep them from getting behind the wheel of a car. If it's not, then the appropriate course is to incarcerate them to prevent yet another death, because these folks aren't learning from their prior behavior. This bill gives many chances, and it requires that they've committed at least 3 prior DUIIs. Now, unlike the felony DUII bill, it does not require that those three DUIIs be within a 10-year period. And I think that that's important because it's astounding the number of defendants that I've personally prosecuted that have DUII convictions running back decades, literally decades, of just continued, repeated convictions. And the statistics that show how many times these folks are actually driving drunk before they're stopped, arrested, and then convicted is astounding. It's something around the neighborhood of 200 times on average that someone is driving drunk before they're actually caught, convicted, and successfully prosecuted. That's a very scary statistic. These folks, it's important that these folks that have the that have multiple DUII convictions, even if they span more than 10 years, be prosecuted under this new law, because if we have a circumstance where today someone were to be convicted of a Measure 11 vehicular manslaughter crime and they actually spent 10 years in prison, then got out and committed yet another vehicular homicide, it lies in the face of any reason that we should give that person a break because their last conviction was so long ago, when perhaps the only reason that their conviction was so long ago was because perhaps they were incarcerated and then again failed to see any benefit from that length of incarceration. I'd also like to remind you, although I'm sure you're all well aware, of how serious the definition is of serious physical injury. This bill will only affect those that have been killed or have been seriously physically injured. And by law, that is a very high standard. These are folks who are permanently disabled, folks who have brain injuries, who are never again the same, folks who have paralysis. Serious physical injury is not something like a severely broken leg. These are people who are changed forever, whose lives have been changed forever. It is my expectation that this will affect, that the people will be, very few people would be prosecuted under this law, so there should not be a significant fiscal impact to the state. But from a policy perspective, the message that this bill would send is so important that I urge all of you to get behind the bill, to tell folks that have been convicted of DUII, that have previously injured people and killed people, that this is a time for change, that if they don't conform their behavior, that they will be incarcerated for a very long time, and that we simply won't tolerate it anymore. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you for your testimony. I just want to say one of the last trials I had for drunk driving in my police career, Ms. Snowden prosecuted, was the deputy district attorney involved, and that involved a young man who was either 21 or 22. It was his fourth drunk driving conviction. His family was outraged that he was facing prison over that. They thought that was just so unfair. The judge refused to hold him until sentencing. Within a month, he was out again, with no license, drunk. He had a high-speed chase with the police, was involved in a hit-and-run, and left, got out and ran, and left behind his injured pregnant girlfriend in the car. And that's just the kind of person who we're talking about today.
Yeah, he was pending sentencing, hit another, T-boned another car running a red light in a stolen vehicle.
Yeah. So, well, thank you very much for your testimony, and especially thank you to the families who came in here today and shared. I just can't imagine the pain you're going through every day, and that this would have to bring that back up. So I don't know how to say it, but I just really appreciate you sharing your suffering with us so that we can understand. And this helps override the arguments from people who are not involved, who talk about the high cost of prison incarceration, which is high, but the cost that the families here have paid today, just those other costs don't come close to that. Thank you. With that, we'll close the public. Or did anybody else testify in this bill? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2828 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2828 to the full committee with due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson, would I think we need to first do the dash two amendments.
We'll back up a notch. Okay, well, I'd like to make a motion to move that into House Bill 2828 there.
I can ask. Hearing no objections, so ordered.
And then as with the amendments, we'd move that to the House floor, or I mean to the full committee with due pass recommendation.
Actually, Mr. Chair, you didn't invite any discussion. I will vote for the bill. I'm concerned about the fiscal. Obviously, these are hard decisions, and we have limited resources, so we have to look at the fiscal impact. And I'm also, although I'll support the bill going up to the full, I think as part of the fiscal analysis, we ought to consider whether lumping this conduct, which is terrible conduct, there's no question about it, but lumping it together with murder is the right solution, or whether we should have some new category which captures sort of the nature of sort of repeat, you know, reckless disregard for the public in one's conduct. It just seems to me that it has a different quality to it, which is a terrible quality, but whether lumping it together with murder is the way to do it. I guess that's an open question in my mind. So I think we ought to ought to be part of the discussion we have surrounding the really likely fiscal impact, which is also part of the analysis we need to go through in consideration in full. So I will vote yes on the bill out of the sub, but I think it needs some more work before we act on it in full.
Okay.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative
Badger? Excuse.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Representative Olson will carry that, if you will. Thank you. Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3452. Ann Pratt, Bonnie, and Sarah Edwards.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Barker and members of the committee. I'm Ann Pratt, for the record, and a member of Crime Victims United. We at Crime Victims United and the Attorney General, Hardy Myers, have requested that Assault 3 be upgraded from a 6 to an 8 on the sentencing grid if committed while under the influence of intoxicants. I believe if we're ever going to make a difference in society's view of driving intoxicated and the 200-plus deaths and 2,000-plus injuries, we need to separate and draw attention to it and make the consequences more severe. We believe House Bill 3452 will not only make the punishment fit the crime, but also will create societal and criminal deterrent effect. These DUI assaults are very often random assaults, just in the case, as in the case of Sarah Edwards, who is with us here today. It's a horrible game of chance. If they had been just a minute later or two, it possibly would not have happened. The pain suffered by these victims is unique. It happened because of someone else having a good time, with total indifference to the consequences of their action and without an ounce of respect for the lives of others. Their pleasure was more important than the lives and health of others. Many times sorrow surfaces at the trial, but it's too late. They should have cared when it mattered. Their selfish, reckless decisions, behavior, and criminal indifference has sacrificed the lives of others. At this point, it is up to the criminal justice system to make the punishment fit the crime and to create deterrence. Here are some facts about DUI assaults. After 25 years of MAD indoctrinating us on the facts of driving while intoxicated, there is no one that does not know it can seriously injure or kill innocent victims. It is also a planned action. Go out, get drunk, drive home. It is not an accident. The punishment needs to fit the crime. And by elevating it from a 6 to an 8, on the sentencing grid, which is a penalty of 90 to 180 days at this point, down to probation, House Bill 3452 would more appropriately sentence this offender to 16 to 18 months, but still does leave room for judicial discretion when it's appropriate. It also raises Assault 3 while under the influence from a Class C felony to a Class B felony. It follows, closely follows suit with a bill that we passed last session, Senate Bill 421, that elevated criminal negligent homicide from an 8 to a 9 while under the influence of intoxicants. This is a violent crime that is 100% preventable. DUI assault is a known risk, just as DUI homicide is a known risk. The cost, according to the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, for each surviving victim of a DUI assault is $108,000. But as you listen to the testimony of Bonnie and Sarah Edwards, you will realize that the cost of assault 3 and serious physical injury very greatly exceeds $108,000, not to mention the emotional costs of these crashes are astronomical. Another recent case is the case of Megan Jones that happened in 2003 in Corvallis. She was the OSU gymnast that was struck by a drunk and drug driver, almost killing her. And she also had DUI and failure to appear. She is making progress, but she also has many, many miles to go. Just recently, there was a case in Portland that I believe you'll hear about today. This bill is supported by Attorney General Hardy Myers, Crime Victims United, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Oregon District Attorneys Association, Association of Oregon Chief of Police, and OSPOA. We urge you to pass this bill, and I thank you for this opportunity. I would be happy to answer any questions. And if there are none, I would like to introduce Bonnie and Sarah Edwards, and I believe Sarah is going to go first.
Okay. Any questions?
Good morning.
Okay, please go ahead.
Okay. I am very privileged to speak to all of you about how our choices are made and how they can interact with our lives. My name is Sarah Edwards, and I am 28 years old right now. I was only 19. I was driving my boyfriend Chance and I out to the lake. There must have been something happening out there, but I lost some memory as a result of the choices of the drinking driver. It's hard to wake up and find out the true facts. We were hit in a head-on car collision at 95 miles an hour. I lost my friend Chance. It's not the same without him. I really miss him too. We both had our seatbelts on too. After the wreck, the paramedics thought I was a goner. They rushed me to the emergency room at Sacred Heart Hospital. I was in a coma for 3 weeks. My brain was so traumatized, I couldn't speak, eat, walk, or hear for a while. The churches that knew us prayed. But when I had gotten a little bit better, they moved me to 6th floor, which is 04. I was still in a wheelchair. My right side was affected, broken teeth, a jammed right foot, which I had surgery on, and the nurses took good care of me, but I was happier when I was able to go home. I spent a lot of time going to the doctor's office. I wanted to be a veterinarian. That was my goal. I did work with Bill Strankruger and Kais Grove. But it's kind of hard to function because I get so tired. In the meantime, I need to find something else to do. Getting better is what I can do now. The cause of this car wreck brought a significant response of disablement to me due to the stupidity of others' actions. I'm relearning basic skills that will meet accomplishment in time. I appreciate those that helped me too. Believe in miracles. I was not supposed to live, or supposed to be here, or live. Thank you for listening. I'm all done.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Barker and the committee. My name is Bonnie Edwards, and I live in Cottage Grove. I support the House Bill 3452. My feelings are strong about this measure because my daughter has sustained a catastrophic collision, and our family is forever affected by another's foolish actions. The criminal in this case received a punishment that did not fit the crime. This bill would place stronger sentencing into effect and demonstrate the seriousness of assault imposed on an innocent victim. It was March 8, 1996, and our phone was ringing. It was about 10:30 at night, and the phone was on my side, so I got to answer it. Our hopes and dreams were crushed, our hearts broken. The words that were spoken were, "Come identify her, hurry, she's not supposed to live." So we were in total shock. Walking into the ICU lobby at Sacred Heart Hospital, it was a place that was foreign to us, and looking across the room, there were two policemen discussing the accident, the collision, and over to the other side was a woman holding a clipboard that I later found out held donor papers. And so we sat and we waited. But finally we got to go back and see Sarah. That it was hard to get next to her because of all the machines and the things that she was hooked up to. And we were to discover that she had a brain injury, but they named it a brain stem injury. I didn't know what that was. She had bleeding throughout her brain. She had a collapsed lung, fractured pelvis. Let's see what else was that? Internal bruising, and was facing exploratory surgery. If she made it through the night, the surgery would be the next morning. I'll talk a little bit about the accident now. There's a caravan of drinking drivers coming back into Cottage Grove from the lake. There was a line of about 15 cars, and the first two cars in the line decided that they would decide who would be first by racing. Sarah and Chance were headed out to the lake. They had just left Chance's mother's home maybe 5 minutes prior to when the accident happened, or the collision happened. And so Sarah and Chance were approaching a small hill. The two head drivers were both coming at them. The one in Sarah's lane facing her was going 95. The one next to that car was going 65. Sarah's car was hit head on over towards the passenger side, which pushed her boyfriend back into the trunk of the car, which turned Sarah's car around, spun it around, and the second car going 65 hit her door at a very strong impact.
so Sarah was really getting bounced around. If you look at the pictures, there doesn't look like there's any room for anyone to even survive that. But she was there kind of in a little cocoon, and that's the story of the accident. Tim Hedrick, who was driving the car at 95, received assault 3 against Sarah and had to serve 90 days in work camp. He also had his license taken away. And Ella was going to serve probation. His license was revoked for 8 years. Between March 8th until the trial came up, and just the first part of December, he was out free. I saw him driving. And upon reporting it, I was told that I had to take a picture of him to prove that I saw him driving. But we were in the middle of an intersection, and so unexpected, it's hard to even prove that what my story was true. And so the other driver, driving 65, had no insurance. She got a citation for reckless driving and a citation for the no insurance. And then she was released. That was her penalty. And I thought, what is that? When a life has been taken and a second person's life affected forever, just 90 days in work camp. Tim Hedrick also received another additional 90 days for killing the passenger in work camp, and these sentences were served concurrently. We are left with the results of this outrageous act of violence for the rest of our lives. It makes me really angry. There's disregard for human value on the criminal's actions, and the punishment is little to nothing. We spent very intense time in the hospital. Sarah was in a coma for 3 weeks, and they did not promise us that she would ever come out of her coma. It was a deep coma. After the 3 weeks in the ICU, she began to wake up. The upper part of her brain was coming to, and she opened one eye, and we were so just ecstatic. From there, they moved her to the sixth floor neuro unit for another a little bit over a week, and then the insurance said that we needed to choose a nursing home and move her. And going back to Tim Hedrick's car insurance, he was underinsured. He had a $20,000 policy, which was divided amongst the kids that were hurt in the collision. And so it was exhausted the first night. I just want to say the world doesn't seem to stop to notice. Sarah's care is ongoing, and my husband and I are there 24/7 for her. She is now on senior and disabled services with a caseworker. Jim and I, my husband and I, are her advocates. I can't imagine anyone having a head injury without having advocates. She has short-term memory loss and still has medical needs, and physical and emotional needs. We transport Sarah wherever she needs to go. We manage the money and scheduling. We look for places and avenues where we can further help her. So it's like being a research person. We also have to protect Sarah from others. There are others out there that want to prey on the disabled, and it's happened to Sarah, and so we stand against that also. Sarah's energy level is very low. She gets very tired because of the brain injury. Mm-hmm. The first year, the insurances from State Farm that Sarah carried on her car, and trying to think what was the other. Oh, and then I worked for Cottage Grove Hospital. She was on my insurance. And so between those two insurances, they paid out $300,000 the first year. We're into the ninth year of recovery, and the costs have not stopped. My insurance was exhausted for Sarah because Cottage Grove Hospital went bankrupt, and that was after the second year of her recovery, and that's at the point that she went on to state assistance. She had a lot of medications that were had to be purchased. We're doing better with that now. She's been eliminated from a lot of those, but there's still needs there. There's many things that aren't covered by the insurance. Sarah's on a very limited income, and so she has to cover a lot of things with a check of like a little over $500 a month. And so Jim and I try to kick in with what we have. It's been a tremendous weight on our family. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about Tim Hedrick's record. Not long after, he had violated his probation by choosing to drive. And while he waited for that hearing, he continued to break the law by getting another DUI. This offender is now in the federal penitentiary serving time for possession of firearms while under probation. He just does not get it. And he's appealing that. He's saying he's not guilty. This is the result of his actions. I'm angry that his actions have affected so many other people. Also, they say a picture is worth a thousand words. And so there's three pictures on that last page. So I'm just going to say that's my last 3,000 words. And I appreciate you listening, and I feel privileged to be here. Thank you. Did you have any questions?
Are there any questions? Anybody? Thank you again very, very much for coming in. Tim Plummer, Pete Shepard, and Kirsten Snowden. Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'm here on behalf of Hardy Myers, who would have been here personally, except that he is chair of the National Association of Attorneys General Committee on Consumer Protection and is attending the conference of that group this week in Washington, D.C. The criminal code reflects some very finely calibrated judgments about the culpability of defendants. And among other things, those judgments take into account and express society's judgment about defendants' relative culpability, and more particularly about the kind of costs that those defendants impose on individuals, families, and on the community. And it's in that context in which I view this bill. The bill really reflects a further refinement of the existing judgments about relative culpability. And what the bill says is that in recognition of these additional costs and risks that arise when a person commits the crime of assault in the third degree under circumstances that include driving under the influence of intoxicants, that it's appropriate for society to recognize that as something different and something deserving of more serious punishment than an assault three committed under other circumstances. And so simply put, this bill makes that further refinement to the gradations that are already reflected in the statute by increasing the punishment to crime classification to a B felony and raising the crime seriousness rating to an 8. The proposal was reviewed in detail by the governor's public safety review process that Governor Kongoski convened during the interim. Attorney General Myers oversaw the adult sentencing subpart of that, the adult sentencing task force, and in that task force, this proposal was reviewed and thoroughly vetted. And although it emerged from that task force, it was not unanimously supported by all members of that very broadly constituted task force. Nonetheless, it was a recommendation of the task force that the steering committee of the governor's process include this in the final list of recommendations. And indeed, the steering committee did do that. So this bill comes before you with the Attorney General's enthusiastic support and with that heritage of a pretty thorough vetting from a lot of folks who've looked at the costs and the that are imposed by these defendants in relation to the judgments already made in current law about how we ought to treat these defendants, and made the judgment that we ought to recognize they impose unique costs and present unique risks.
I think you have any questions?
Thank you, Chair Barker, committee members. Again, Kirsten Snowden from Multnomah County. I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 3452 because I personally feel very strongly about this bill. I think that assault in the third degree, as it is currently written, is one of the biggest in the sentencing guidelines as they pertain to assault in the third degree are just horribly inequitable. Under Mount Measure 11, as you're currently aware, if someone drinks and drives and recklessly causes the death of another person, then they have committed manslaughter in the second degree and face a mandatory minimum of 75 months prison. However, if the same conduct occurs and someone is seriously physically injured, and it's wonderful that Sarah and Bonnie were able to come today because they're a perfect example of just that type of injury and how this can affect people's lives. But that exact same conduct, if it does not result in the death of someone, means probation. That makes no sense. The fact that we have a law that protects society and says the consequences of your actions, if you drink and drive and kill someone, are so severe that we think it is warranted that you spend 70 months in prison, yet in the same breath we're saying, well, if there's only serious physical injury, then it's appropriate that you get probation. That doesn't make any sense. Quite frankly, while I enthusiastically support House Bill 3452, I don't think it goes nearly far enough. I think that quite simply, assault in the second degree, as it is currently defined, needs to be altered. The language of committing recklessly causing serious physical injury, assault 2 currently requires, the particular subsection I'm referring to requires that if someone recklessly causes serious physical injury to another by means of a dangerous or deadly weapon, which would include a vehicle, under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life, then and only then are they subject to the assault to ballot measure 11 sentence. As a prosecutor, I can tell you just how incredibly difficult it is to convict someone of conduct that manifests extreme indifference to the value of human life. I have repeatedly seen trials where folks have been drunk, where they've been eluding police, where they've run through multiple red lights, where they've actually collided with other vehicles prior to then hitting someone else, and a jury has not found that conduct to be manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. Our current sentencing guidelines do not capture the severity of the consequences to victims that are seriously physically injured as a result of someone's reckless behavior. With this amendment, which would elevate assault in the third degree from a level 6 to a level 8, someone with relatively little criminal history would still be in the optional probation category, which would mean someone with no criminal history could get 16 months in prison, but in fact a judge could give them something less than that, which would be probation. With my suggested amendment to assault in the second degree, which I hope at some point occurs, we wouldn't be looking at optional probation. We wouldn't be looking at even the sentencing guidelines. We'd be holding someone to that ballot measure 11 mandatory minimum sentence, which is appropriate when you consider that we've said as a society it's warranted that you get a ballot measure 11 sentence if you kill someone. It should also be warranted if someone has suffered serious physical injury. I've seen cases where people have sustained severe brain injury, much more severe than that we heard about from Sarah, where they're in a nursing home, when they're in a persistent vegetative state, and that the people who have caused that injury recklessly while driving under the influence are getting probationary sentences. And currently there is no mechanism to give them anything more than that. That simply makes no sense. It's appalling. And if you cause that kind of significant injury to someone else, then you should be paying the price. You should be held accountable and hopefully be sending a message to others. You probably all read in the Oregonian, it's somewhat ironic that just last weekend, a Washington County deputy district attorney who was on call as the person who would respond to the very accident he was involved in, was hit by an allegedly drunk driver. His neck was broken, and it's unknown whether or not he'll ever walk again. That is serious physical injury. And that person, if that person were to get probation, if like what we heard from in Sarah's case, 90 days work release, that is, it's terribly unjust. It's one of the greatest injustices I see in our entire sentencing guideline scheme, and I urge you all to pass House Bill 3452.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Krieger?
Maybe just a statement before I have to leave. You had three police officers retired that sit on this committee, and I was recalling the first DUI that I ever went to when I was a recruit in 1964. I've been on the state police about 60 days, something of that, still with my coach, and that involved the death of a 9-month-old baby who went through a window as a result of a DUI, and it was a real quick learner how bad accidents are. That family still, I believe, lives in the Port Orford area. And so if you think back to 1964, they've lived with that for 40-some years. These bills will go out of this committee, and I'm confident that they'll go off the House floor. We just got to get the job done over the Senate.
Okay, questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm ready to move.
Okay. Close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3452 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson? Representative
Thatcher?
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And Representative McPherson?
Okay.
Representative McPherson Ferry? Yes, that's okay. I'm going to take the next one out of order a bit here. Representative Kitts has been up here. I asked him to show up at 9:30, and I know he's got a very busy schedule, so we'll go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 3420. Thank you for waiting, Representative Kitts.
My pleasure. We're doing good work.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Derek Kitts, State Representative from Hillsborough, House District 30. I believe that you have before you the Dash 1 amendments to 3419. I don't want to be redundant and read them, but if Heidi wants to.
Okay. Close hearing on 3420 and open hearing on 3419.
Mr. Chair, please, in committee, I'd also like to ask Mr. Pat Schreiner, who testified in opposition to House Bill 3419 the last time, to come up and sit with me if he's amenable to that.
That would be fine.
Uh,
Members of the committee, you may recall that House Bill 3419, we first heard testimony on April 5th, and this is the bill that would prohibit more than one sex offender living in the same transitional housing or living together. Representative Kitts, I know, along with Mr. Schreiner, worked hard on these amendments, and they were received by my office yesterday afternoon. I was in another meeting, and so I would actually rely on Representative Kitts to tell us a little bit about the amendments, as I have not given them an opportunity. I have not had an opportunity to review them.
Hi. Thank you, and I'm sorry, I apologize. I should have gotten the amendments to you sooner than that, so that blame lies on myself. I've read through the amendments. The Pat and John Hartner, who's the head of County Corrections for Washington County, worked on the amendments. So I'm going to let John, as a result of House Bill 3419, Mr. Chairman, as you know all too well, as do all members of this body, that we seem to have good ideas sometimes, but they have extenuating ramifications that need to be addressed. And I think the amendments that have been brought forward by the county corrections folks in this situation have addressed the concerns of the people of Hillsborough, have addressed my concerns. So I'm going to let Mr. Schreiner elaborate a bit on the Dash 1 amendments.
Good morning, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Pat Schreiner with the Marion County Sheriff's Office, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network. Representative Kitts is accurate. John Hartner, the Director of Community Corrections, Bob Sevier, who is the primary supervisor for the Sex Offender Supervision Unit in Washington County, and myself had a really productive meeting with Representative Kitts about this bill. I think, you know, some of the differences we had, we all agreed that the bill was well-intentioned. We all agreed that of having a lot of sex offenders in one house could create a significant concern in the community, and we all agreed that community corrections needs to work with the community in dealing with those issues. We believe the amendments that we have proposed will address that. And really what we've asked, what we've done in changing these amendments is that when you are going to use group housing, or, you know, offenders are going to be living together, whether it's a transitional house or a house in a community, in a neighborhood, that it needs to be approved all the way up to, it can be approved all the way up to the director of community corrections, who has an obligation to work with the community and communicate about the issues as to why this is the best living arrangement for these people. So we think in short that will cover it. We initially agreed that if two offenders were living there, that would be approved by the supervisor of the sex offender unit if it was a larger county. If it was more than two, then it would go to the deputy director or the director. Really what it requires is that community corrections would have to have a policy in place to designate that, and the communication would be going up to the director of that agency, and that policy should include a way to communicate with the community, much like we do with notification.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Representative. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to Representative McPherson, who met with me post our last meeting, we had discussed a number, and we came up with a number of three. The reason that it's not that agreement that you and I had talked about was not implemented, it wasn't that simple. It wasn't just a matter of saying a number. There are far-reaching ramifications, and I apologize not having had the time to come and talk with you and explain that in advance of this committee. But the reason for that, it wasn't just as simple as implementing a number. The original bill, admittedly so, was a very simplistic approach to a far bigger problem that's been explained to me in far greater detail than I ever wanted, but very, very good detail at that. But it wasn't. The bill was a simplistic fix. I think what we have here is not a preemptive measure by the state to dictate to the county corrections folks, but rather to say to the county corrections folks, let's get some system in place that has some guidelines on how we deal with these, as opposed to telling them what they can or can't do in dealing with these folks.
And so if I understand the amendments right, a number of people could be in those in a home, but this would be under very close scrutiny. Mm-hmm. What kind of corrections? Not the case we brought in originally from Hillsborough, where there was, I believe, 8 people living in a house right in a residential neighborhood with no supervision at all, was the concern.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. What it does is for anything beyond 2, it varying degrees of checkoff, if you will, so that there is supervision there and parameters put in place.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions?
Chair Barker, no. Members of the committee, can I add a little bit
sure.
to that? Just
okay.
Because I just want to talk, at least address a little bit what we're talking about. We talk about close scrutiny. One of the conversations we had with Representative Kitts, and we're actually still gathering some data for him statewide on how many offenders are living together. It might be, I think I mentioned in there, there's, I think there's 6 in Marion County that are actually living together, and it's been approved by their parole and probation officers, it's been approved by their treatment provider. But in that living arrangement, they're living there, they're renting together, so the scrutiny is the supervision and the treatment, just like somebody that would be living on their own individually. And then there is also transitional housing, and so that there was also some discussion about people who are coming out of prison, people who are coming out of jail, who lack resources and go into transitional housing. That could be the United Union Gospel Mission. And, you know, yes, there's some scrutiny and there's some supervision there. I wouldn't necessarily always call it close scrutiny, but there is some. There are also transition houses that offenders go to that have varying levels of that scrutiny. Again, what this bill requires is that the parole and probation officer is partly responsible for that scrutiny by making home visits, by visiting that place. The treatment provider has to approve this living arrangement, and they have to approve who is living in this house together. So that's what the level of scrutiny is. It does not mean that there's 24/7 on-site supervision.
Yeah, thank you. I understand. And thank you very much for bringing your expertise and helping these bills get some, you know, on-the-ground information. Thank you. Any questions?
Really not a question, Mr. Chair, but if I could just respond to my good friend, Representative Kitts. No need to bring that back. All of us have been in the situation of having proposed something that on the surface seemed like a great idea, and then you find when you penetrate it needs more detail, and I appreciate the work that you've done to bring a good resolution to the problem.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next, I have different. Okay.
So, we're in work session.
Yeah, I actually opened public hearing, but it's a work session. I'll open a work session on that. Could I have a motion to amend?
Mr. Chair, I move -1 amendments into 3419.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3419 as amended to the full committee with due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Representative Thatcher, carry please.
Will Representative Kitts want to carry it on the floor?
Yeah, okay. We'll make a note of that when we have a full committee on Friday.
Yeah.
Representative Ryan may want to
go here. Okay. We'll make a note of that. Thank you. Okay, now.
Now 3420. Get him back up here.
And 3420, Representative Kitts again, please.
The committee, for the record, again, my name is Derek Kitts. I'm state representative from House District 30. Mr. Chair, House Bill 3420 admittedly show, while I don't think it falls under the same quote-unquote simplistic view that we had last of the 3419. I'll let Heidi go ahead and read her summary if she so chooses, and then I'll proceed.
Thank you, Representative Kitts. Members of the committee, House Bill 3420 does two things. The first thing that it does is it modifies the statute of limitations for sex crimes against persons under 18 years of age. You, I'm sure, recall that we did do this in House Bill, I believe it was 2015, and it was slightly different. I have had a request to amend Section 1 to mirror House Bill 2015. I will obviously take direction from the committee on that. The second part, however, is the newer part and something that we have not considered before, and that would create a Class A misdemeanor in situations when a person has reasonable cause to believe that a felony sex crime has been committed against a minor, and the sex crime has to have not been reported to a law enforcement agency already, and if that person learns that this offense has occurred, they know that it hasn't been reported to law enforcement, this bill gives that person 30 days to report it to law enforcement themselves, or they will be guilty of this new Class A misdemeanor.
Thank you. Thank you, Heidi. I think that, Mr. Chairman, I think your committee administrator has touched on the core concepts of the bill. There is some opposition to the bill and some legitimate opposition to the bill. There are some questions that are raised as a result of these ramifications that the bill would impose. If it pleases the chair, in the name of time, I think anything that I would say beyond what Heidi has said would just be redundant. If there are any questions for me of the committee, I'm more than happy to answer them. If not, I would be very open to allowing the opponents of the bill to come forward. And what I would assume is going to happen, or what I would like to see happen, is possibly a work group put together to hammer out some of the differences. We tried at the beginning of session for several months, incorporating several different groups of people. I mean, you can tell by the bipartisan support of the bill, we'd like something in the area to be done. However, there are certain aspects of the bill and extending ramifications of the bill that, quite frankly, I don't want to happen. So I would assume that at the end of the testimony, you're going to have a work group assigned, if it's the prerogative of the chair, to hammer out some of these things. But if there's any questions of me at this time, I'm more than happy to answer them.
Questions? Okay, thank you very much, and thank you for,
thank
sorry
you.
About the delay. Mr. Hummel and Ms. Hebb.
Morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is John Hummel. I'm an attorney in Bend, and today I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. OCDLA is opposed to this bill because when statute of limitations are expanded, the risk of erroneous convictions increases. This is just common sense. As years pass, memories fade, documents disappear, and witnesses die. When statute of limitations are increased to the extent proposed by House Bill 3420, an innocent person's defense might become, I did not touch the alleged victim. I know that, but I can't remember where I was on the date of the incident. I have no records to prove where I was, and the witnesses who can help me prove I was not with her have died. But please find me not guilty. The Oregon Legislative Assembly has previously debated this issue and determined that 24 years of age for the victim was the appropriate end date for bringing a claim of child sex abuse. There is no rational basis for increasing the age to 28. Likewise, if this bill passes, there will be no rational basis for increasing the age to 30 or 32 or 34, which is the bill you'll see in the next Legislative Assembly. To avoid the risk of innocent convictions and to stop this train of incremental, non-rationally based public policy changes, OCDLA respectfully urges that House Bill 3420 be defeated. Now, that having been said, as your counsel pointed out, I am keenly aware that the statute of limitations has been increased in a previous bill. So I am aware of that. We will continue to voice objections whenever bills such as this come about for the reasons I've just stated. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Hummel?
Mr. Chair, I have a question, and it actually doesn't go to the statute of limitations issue that was, I think, aired and debated rather thoroughly in this committee and on the floor. The other part of the bill that I guess I'm focusing on, the crime of failure to report a felony sex crime against a minor, is this as much sort of a new concept as it strikes me? That is, that we're going to, we have mandatory child abuse reporting, but do we have any other example where we tell, we've identified people who know about some third party committing an offense and we make it criminal conduct for them not to come forward?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, this is a, you are correct, this is quite a departure from criminal justice procedures and policies. This would be a new class of crime, a class of crime that puts a burden on a citizen of this community who's not a police officer or a prosecutor, a citizen of this community who's aware of a criminal act to report the criminal act or be committing a crime themselves. You are correct that we do have the mandatory reporting elements of sex abuse, but those do not impose a sanction of a criminal conviction on a person who does not so report. So you are correct, this is a significant departure from current policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Mullen.
Mr. Hummel, I know that the Senate Judiciary is considering a bill that would increase the penalty for mandatory reporters who fail to report. Have you testified on that, or do you know what that?
Council Moet, I do not. I personally have not testified on that. I don't know the status of that bill right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hummel. Ms. Hebb.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb, and I'm the legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center, which provides civil legal assistance to low-income Oregonians throughout the state. I want to express my appreciation to Representative Kitts for his work in trying to address this really important issue and for his goal of providing accountability for perpetrators. I've spoken with him and have appreciated the ability to do that and have expressed my concerns specifically about Section 2 of the bill, which is the part that would apply to or would create the crime of failure to report. And my concerns are twofold, really. One is that there would be this departure so that the duty would apply to all people, regardless of whether they're mandatory reporters or not, and regardless of what age they are. So the way I read the bill, if a victim confided in her sister, for example, her sister would be guilty of the crime of failure to report, regardless of how old her sister was, and regardless of the sister's capacity to really adequately weigh and understand all of the circumstances. And so we have a concern in terms of sort of the roles that it places family members in with respect to one another, and the position that it puts those non-educated and trained reporters in trying to make these important decisions. And the other, you may be sort of wondering why in the world the Law Center has a position on this bill, because our expertise is not in the criminal realm, and we don't prosecute cases or we're not involved in cases of child abuse. But in the past years, we have been developing a prioritization of services to victims of domestic violence and of sexual assault. And we have begun to understand, or I have begun to understand, how important it is, how scary it is when a victim decides to come forward, and how important it is to have a distinction between people who are charged with the duty to then take that confidential disclosure and report it somewhere, and people who can play a supportive role and help facilitate that victim's ability to come forward at a different stage. And we've seen many people, I think, who have talk to us about how they were prohibited, they were afraid to come forward, they were worried about the consequences, and it was that sort of initial ability to come forward in a way that didn't have consequences and didn't automatically trigger a report to law enforcement that enabled them to come to start to address the issues. So it won't be true for everybody, but it's an important distinction, and I would just ask the committee to be, in considering this issue and in any other bills related to mandatory reporting of abuse, to look at the larger picture of the implications for victims, and I think it's important to make sure to talk with people who are mandatory reporters and who have struggled with this issue for and have expertise in the issue before making any decisions. So very much appreciate your time. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you. Any questions? Well, I appreciate your time and paying attention to these things, because like we've just been discussing, there's good intentions, and all of a sudden the focus gets too narrow and we don't see these problems. So I'll close it with that. I'll close the public hearing on 3420, and we'll take a look at that down the road. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2316.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2316 is going to be replaced by the Dash 1 amendments in its entirety. House Bill 2316 does two things if the Dash 1 amendments are adopted. The first thing that it would do is it would modify the procedures used by the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision in determining whether or not an offender is a predatory sex offender. Earlier this year, in February, the Oregon Supreme Court came out in VLY versus Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision and interpreted the predatory sex offender statutes to mean that, or interpreted it in such a way that the portion of the statute saying that the individual exhibits characteristics showing a tendency to victimize or injure others meant that there had to be a very sort of present threat. And so and that, of course, is extremely difficult to determine. And the Department of Corrections Board of Parole uses a risk assessment scale, and so they wanted to modify the statute so that it reflected better how they have been practically determining the predatory sex offender designation. The second part of this comes to us from District Attorney Bernice Barnett from Lincoln County, and it would create a new set of statutes that would provide for community notification. Currently, a predatory sex offender, when they move into a community, the community is notified under the law. Other sex offenders, however, as we've heard in other testimony, an individual would have to be proactive in determining whether or not there was a sex offender living in their neighborhood. This would require community notification or enable departments to do community notification when a person has been convicted of the three Class A felony sex offenses. Those are rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, and unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree.
Thank you. Ms. Thompson, Mr. Washington, and Pat Trainer again, please.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Is that mic at the right?
You want to say it again?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
I didn't know if anyone knew that. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marcia Thompson, and I live in Newport, Oregon, where I work for the Lincoln County District Attorney's Office as a victim's advocate. I'd like to apologize first. Bernice Barnett, the district attorney, planned on being here this morning but could not get away from the office, so I drove over to testify in support of Section 2 of the proposed amendment in House Bill 2316. I'd like to make it very clear I'm not an attorney, so I could not sufficiently address any legal questions. However, my understanding of the magnitude of the problem surrounding the lack of proper public notification of sexually violent offenders is something I work with every day. The amendment before you focuses on community notification of sexually violent rapists and sexual abusers of children who target children 11 years old and under. This is not a punishment issue, it is a safety issue. Those sexual offenders listed will only be the worst of the worst. It will be an information tool to notify parents of young children and our communities as a whole to reduce the chances of further victimization by registered offenders. The proposed amendment will simplify the law. It will provide that any person convicted of rape one, sodomy one, or sexual penetration one can be listed on the Internet without any further determination by the Department of Corrections regarding the predatory nature of the offender. Under Oregon law, in order for sexual offenders to be listed publicly, they must be designated as a predatory sexual offender by the Oregon State Department of Corrections. Recent decisions of the courts have limited the designation even more. And my testimony is very short. I'm just here to say that this amendment will save one child or victim from a violent sexual crime. It is essential that we put this law into effect. I appreciate your taking the time to listen to me, and I ask each of you to take serious consideration to support this important amendment to House Bill 2316.
Thank you. Any questions? Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Thatcher, I guess, and members of the committee. My name is Michael Washington. I'm Chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, and I'm here to testify in support of Section 1 of House Bill 2316. As Council Moore had indicated, the board, this is important for the board in light of the Supreme Court decision in the VLY versus the Board of Parole, Post-Prison Supervision, and where that case really attacked the process upon which the board designated offenders as predatory sex offenders. And if the amendment that is being put forth in Section 1 of this bill isn't passed, the fiscal impact to the board can be devastating, and due to the fact that the board's only option to be able to adequately designate persons as predatory with the statute as it's currently structured would be to either hire an additional person with a psychological background or at least something that's consistent with that to be able to testify in opposition at each hearing where the board is to establish a person as predatory sex offender to show that they do not presently exhibit the characteristics that show that a tendency to victimize or injure others. And this amendment allows the board to be able to continue to designate predatory sex offenders in its current posture and process without having to go through that very expensive and unduly laborious process in being able to designate these offenders as predatory in a very efficient and quick manner, because the purpose of the predatory designation is to allow community corrections to be able to notify the communities that these offenders are going to be residing in of their presence there. And with the process of having to establish more testimony from a psychologist or having a psychological evaluation to be used to rebut whatever these offenders would indicate that they are not presently showing these tendencies or exhibiting these characteristics showing a tendency to victimize or injure others, that would prolong the predatory designation, thus having these offenders out in the community without the designation and without an opportunity for community corrections to notify the community of these offenders' presence. And so from a public safety standpoint, the board is urging that this committee adopt House Bill 2316 in Section 1 to allow it to be able to protect the public with this designation as it's currently been doing.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, I'm Pat Schreiner with the Marion County Sheriff's Office, Parole and Probation, speaking on behalf of OACCD, which is the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, and the Sex Offender Supervision Network. I find myself in a position of want to strongly support the adoption under Section 1. I really didn't know about Section 2 until Ms. Moad covered that in the beginning. I have some I think we have some concerns about Section 2. But first let me address Section 1. The Supreme Court ruling in BLY has prohibited the parole board from designating any offenders predatory since February 10th of this year. We believe this bill will address this issue. Of all the bills that are being addressed relative to sex offenders in this committee, we believe this one is the most important. Community notification is a very valuable tool in promoting community safety and in educating the community about this population that is in their presence. It's a significant piece to our community supervision plan for the high-risk predatory sex offender. And this allows us, with that population, to use the eyes and ears of people in the community to help us to intervene. Very often, 90% of the offenders we're dealing with, probably closer to 95%, establish some kind of grooming, some kind of relationship. They're not just jumping out of a bush and attacking. And it, very often, it's members of the community who can help us. And it also helps the offender know that members of the community know who they are, and if they initiate contact, if they start talking to children, if they're going in places where children congregate, somebody's going to call parole probation and say, this person's in violation. We can take action then and intervene early. So we strongly support this section of the bill. The other section of the bill, which would make automatic notification on the listed crimes, raises some levels of concern. And one I would mention that right now in the various counties, probably 20 to 25% of the sex offenders under supervision already are being designated predatory with the existing process. And there is a process, and there is a risk assessment process that is being used to determine that. And part of why we adopted the tool we adopted was because it has the greatest credibility and validity as far as risk assessment goes for this population. One of the places that you're seeing the greatest growth and knowledge come out of corrections lately is in the ability to improve risk assessment. And if we expand this to just specific crimes instead of the risk assessment and the process that we already have, you might be able to just toss out this process that we're talking about that we have for designating somebody predatory and just say, if you've been convicted of these crimes, you're going to be notified on, and if you haven't been convicted of these crimes, you're not. I think that's actually a step backwards rather than forward. The other one, the issue of if we just add it on, it will increase notifications. And I will tell you that increasing notifications does not make the community safer. We need to be able to conduct notifications on the people that present the greatest risk. What I can tell you about Marion County is there are parts of the community in Marion County that have received so many notifications, they're immune to it. They forget who the people are. And so one of the processes is we need to be able to come forward with the people that are the highest risk, that we want people to remember them and to be aware of them. With sex offender registration, with working with your community corrections agency, you have the ability to find out who high-risk people are in your community already. So I would argue against a more of a shotgun approach. And then I would also close with part of the conversation we had with Representative Kitts, and I can't speak for all counties, but when we were talking about this previous bill, one of the things we advised him of in both Washington and Marion County, recidivism rates for people, sexual recidivism for people on supervision, in treatment, being monitored, over the last 3 years, which is how the state measures it, was less than 5%. So, these people are being managed effectively in the community as it is.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Yes. I do, Mr. Chair. I guess, Pat, this is for you, or Michael, or Marcia. You can chip in, too, if you want to, or chime in with whatever. I've been pretty involved in what's going on throughout the state here the last few months because I have a grandfather that's extremely upset that lives in Benton County in North Albany part concerning the notification of predators. And as I've done my homework on this, I see that each parole and probation, depending on the county, there's no consistency for notification. There absolutely is none. And I am concerned with what to do for notifying and keeping parents as well as grandparents and schools notified of what's going on. Benton County Sheriff's Office does an outstanding job in providing notification. Linn County does not. Theirs is, as you described, you can come and find out who is on the list. That's their means of notification. What I'm wanting to do is, what do you do to try to bridge all of that through 36 counties and identify and get something together that's consistent that we can depend on for grandparents, parents, schools?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, and members of the committee, I hear what you're saying, and that may be a significant problem. I do know that next week we have our Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors meetings, and this is a significant issue that I'm actually responsible to chair the discussion. So I appreciate you bringing it up because I can bring that to that committee. I have tended to be an advocate for local decision-making in each of these community corrections agencies, but I think one of the things that I'm becoming aware of, particularly from coming before this committee this session, is there is a sense of discontent and unhappiness sometimes about the way this is being done in different parts of the state. And so I believe you are accurate. There is some inconsistency. We are going to be addressing that in this meeting. I do not have a specific answer for you today, but we will be working on that.
Chair Barker, may I, and Representative Olson, and the members of the committee, I can't tell you how much I agree with everything you just said, Representative Olson. It is not working in Lincoln County. With all due respect, this is not a shotgun approach. This is a tremendous need in our communities so that people are aware. This actually came to my attention because I walked into the investigator that works for the DA's office some weeks ago and asked him for some information on a case, child sex abuse case that we were working on. And I was informed at that time that he was one of the only people who could tap into a website listing only predatory offenders, only with a code. So then I found out that the average citizen cannot do that at all. And there is a phone number that's available, and they can get some information. But I can tell you that this system is broken, and it is affecting our communities. It's affecting the safety of our children and our communities. And I come here today out of huge passion and concern because after 2.5 years of working as a victim's advocate, I can tell you that it may be working in some counties, but I can just speak for Lincoln County. It is not working in Lincoln County. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Yes. We're really pushing against the time. Now I've got two more bills I need to hear.
Can I make one comment just to piggyback on that? I'm sorry, but that is exactly one of the issues that we're going to be talking about at this meeting. In fact, it is something that I've recommended, that I've learned through this legislative process, is I really think that we have a predatory website here in Marion County that anybody can access. And one of the discussions at our meeting next week is if everybody had that website, if all 36 counties, at least, that's part of the modern age, is having those kind of websites. So that is one of the discussions, and I do think that is appropriate.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, panel.
Mr. Schreiner, I'm sorry, when did you say that meeting's going to be? Next week, but what day of the week?
May 11th and May 12th.
Okay. Then maybe we should set this for May 17th.
Okay. Mr. Hummel, I'm not going to go to work process day with you. We'll set it for the 17th. So would you want to wait to testify then?
Pass on this one.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2316. We'll set this for a work session on the 17th so we can kind of try to get the problems ironed out.
I believe the way it's set today, even if we passed it out of the House, it would not be going anywhere beyond that, and we don't want to waste everybody's time. Open a work session on 3469. Public hearing on House Bill 3469. Mr. McDonald.
As Mr. McDonald is coming up, Chair Barker and members of the committee, House Bill 3469 is here at the request of the Speaker of the House. She could not be here today, but so I told her that I would pass on to you very briefly the reason why this is here. In Portland, late last year, it looks like Mr. McDonald's actually going to testify about the specific case. So I will just say that this bill creates two crimes. The first crime is when an individual is a predatory sex offender, sexually violent dangerous offender, or a dangerous offender who was convicted of a sex crime, if they knowingly enter or remain in or upon premises where persons under 18 years of age regularly congregate, they would be guilty of a Class C felony. Likewise, same prior designations, if they had contact with a child under 18 years of age that was without the permission of the parents, having been fully advised of the individual's status, or absent a court order, it would create a second Class C felony.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonald. I'm a senior deputy district attorney for Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Chair Barker, with your agreement, I would like to call Mr. Hummel forward. I think we have worked out any differences that we might have between us on this bill. This bill addresses a problem, and a specific problem that arose in southwest Portland. There was a predatory sex offender named Terry Martin. He had been convicted of child rape in the state of Washington and sexual abuse in Oregon and other crimes, and had been designated a predatory sex offender by the state of Washington. He came to the attention of Portland law enforcement officials when parents at a southwest Portland recreational center complained that Mr. Martin was lurking in the locker room of the swimming pool, and he had the odd habit of always showing up and taking a shower naked when their young boys were showering after their swimming classes. Well, an investigation revealed that Mr. Martin had befriended a lot of these children, had lended them movies, and even had offered to take some of them on skiing trips. So this would address that particular problem. Now, it's my understanding that Mr. Hummel has objection to the breadth of the second part of the bill in Section 2, the crime of unlawful contact with the children. And I can see his concern, and I to avoid constitutional challenges on overbreath, we've worked out a compromise, and if I could forward the language to counsel, I think it'll take care of the problem.
Thank you.
And essentially what the proposal amendment would do is say that it would modify that a person commits a crime of unlawful contact with a child if the person normally contacts a person under 18 years of age with the intent of committing a crime or for the purpose of arising or satisfying the sexual desires of either that person or another person.
Well, we can move it out of this. I mean, let's hear from John, but we can move it out of the slip today and I can get it taken care of. I'm excited for it.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, John Hummel, representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Mr. McDonald is correct with the amendment he just related. My organization's concerns are addressed.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? We'll close the public hearing. We'll open our work session. And what I would like to do is go ahead and move this one out. We'll, by when it hits the full committee, it'll have the amendments, and we can revisit. And it's my anticipation, without the amendments, I won't be supporting it. So
right. Okay. Mr. Chair,
Then I move House Bill 3469 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, with the expectation that there will be the dash one amendments presented to us in full and that meet the description that was presented to us just now.
Thank you.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And you are here, Representative McPherson. Okay. Open a work session on 2803. Ms. Maud, do you want to tell us about the amendments?
Please? Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2803 defines unloaded for the purposes of the offense of operating a snowmobile or all-terrain vehicle while carrying a firearm or bow. You may recall when we heard testimony on April 5th, the concern was the definition of unloaded for a revolver, and the dash one amendment will change the definition of revolver so that it will say that a revolver does not have a round of ammunition for the or under the firing pin for the next or under the firing pin. That's what it's going to say. So that is the proponent's exact language, and that is the dash one amendment.
Okay, and everybody remember this bill?
Oh, yes. Well, I'd make motion then.
We're in work session. Go ahead.
We're in work session.
Yeah. Okay. There we are.
To move dash one amendments to House Bill 2803.
Are there any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I would go ahead and move then House Bill 2803 with dash one amendments to the committee with due pass recommendation.
Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And Representative Olson, carry that. Any no further business before the committee today? Adjourned.